You have one unheard message.
Hi, I was calling Current, the influencer marketing platform, but I think I just got redirected to a bunch of people listening to a podcast. Well, anyways, I was calling Current because I was told they could help get my brand set up on TikTok Shop and even build out an affiliate program of content creators promoting my brand and even have those content creators go on live streams and promote my product there. Wow, I could really use Current. I also heard that the brands they work with are making millions in sales. I guess I'll just go to their website at current.tech.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Let's get ready to rumble!
Senior Nation jam-packed show today.
Hey, I don't know if we're live. Are we live?
I think we are. I don't know what happened to the intro there, but it cut off about halfway through.
Yeah, I didn't do that. Did you do that?
No. Well, welcome everyone to the Friday edition of Power Hour. We have a jam-packed show today. Coming up here at noon Eastern, we have Kim Rivers, the CEO of Trueleave. Then at 12:15, Ed Lavery from Similar Web will be joining us. 12:30, we've got BioLargo coming on. And then 12:45, Tim Kwas from Market Structure Edge will be with us. So four guests today in 1 hour. Like I said, Spence, it'll be jam-packed.
Yeah, I'm doing my best here, everyone, to be a functioning member of the stream. I've got limited screen space, limited computer functionality, but I'm here, and I want to see some likes, and I want to see some comments in the chat, because COVID can't stop me. COVID can't stop this.
Look, Spencer, now there's two of you on the screen.
Oh my gosh. Don't do that. Go back to... Also, AB, we should probably tell the people, this may be one of the last quote-unquote power hours that we do, because we are in the midst of a midday rebrand.
Well, yes and no. I mean, it won't be the, you know, end of Power Hour as we know it. Well, it might be the end of Power Hour as we know it, but it's not like we won't have, you know, this similar content in this time slot, just maybe with a different name, some different branding, but
different studio, different studio setup, different branding, different intro, different everything. Potentially, stay tuned. More to come on that next week, perhaps. Speaking of next week, you know what else is next week?
The Benzinga Cannabis Capital Conference.
That's the one. You see it on the bottom right of your screen, bzcannabis.com. Our first in-person event since COVID. It's been a year and a half, more than a year and a half since we've had an in-person event. We are all extremely, extremely excited. Looks like I'm probably not going anymore, unfortunately, but that's the way the cookie crumbles sometimes.
So Spencer, you've been to these cannabis conferences before. I have not. What can attendees kind of expect?
Okay, that's a great question, Aaron Bree. Basically, it's an entire conference devoted to learning about the public and private cannabis markets from an investment perspective, right? Healthy or not healthy is, or where in the cycle are we for the public cannabis market, for the private cannabis market? What are the next catalysts that investors need to know about? What are the companies that are on people's radar? If you are an investor in cannabis, frankly, this is the conference for you. If you're interested in cannabis, it's not so much a conference for like, hey, this is like the next hot new product. This is the next hot new brand. It's more like, hey, this is the next hot new business model, right? This is what we're seeing as far as deal flow. There's a lot of money flowing into the space. There's not a lot of money flowing into the space. These are the companies that are, you know, separating themselves from the pack, et cetera, et cetera. Those are the questions that'll get answered next week. It's not like, oh, what's the best product? What's the best vape pen? What's the best edible? It's not about that. Now, based on past experience, there will maybe some samples. Actually, this might be, I think this is the first time we're doing a cannabis event in New York. So I don't know about that, because we've done them in Toronto, in Chicago, and in Miami. But I don't think we've done one in New York before, so I'm not sure how that impacts things as far as samples are concerned. But it, honestly, it's a pretty chill conference. It's not like a super stuffy, like, not a lot of suits, right? It's cannabis, right? It's chill. And everyone there is interested in the industry and wants to make money. And so if that's you, then it's for you.
Yeah,
if it's not, then that's fine.
And this specific conference is actually hybrid. So if you're unable to make it in person, you are able to sign up virtually. I'm going to go ahead and drop that link in the chat for anyone interested, because I know I won't be there in person, but I will still be tuning in to some of these keynote speakers and seeing what some of these companies have to say virtually. Again, link is in. Please check it out if you have not already. Okay, Spencer, let's talk about the markets today. So right now I have Tesla pulled up on my screen. Tesla, of course, had an investor call last night. It looks like the stock is trading slightly lower, down about 1.5%, which is not a terribly big move for Tesla, which is, of course, historically very volatile.
Well, you know what's interesting? Wait. Don't stay off. Don't leave this chart. Don't leave this chart. This chart, look how quiet Tesla's been, right, in the last, what is that, couple weeks?
This is going back to actually.
Well, I see what's going back, but like, just look at the ranges
right here.
Look how quiet Tesla's been. Is that since that's the last couple weeks, right? Yeah, Tesla's been super quiet. You don't see that from Tesla very often.
I mean, even this whole move up that we can see, this sustained uptrend, it's been kind of like a slow grind up, which we were, of course, used to more moves like this with Tesla, where it just shoots up, you know, 10% a day and then down a little bit, then 10%, you know, whatever. Whereas this time, it's been more of a steady ride up. So definitely some interesting price actions to watch on Tesla. I think right here, Spencer, will be an interesting, you know, line in the sand, per se, to watch. Because we have some slowing down in the upward momentum. So I wouldn't be surprised if we maybe come back down and test these support levels down here. But if we can, you know, break through of this channel that it's been trading in, as you mentioned, the past week or 2 weeks or so, kind of been trading sideways, then, you know, we could potentially run up and meet these previous, you know, resistance spots.
Wait, AB, here's what I want you to do. I want you to, like, only look at the last couple weeks, and then I want you to bring up, I want you to compare it to, like, if you can bring it, like, overlay the chart on top of it, like Apple and Facebook and a couple other FANG stocks, if you can. I just want to see, because Tom Brady is saying Tesla's trading like the mega caps, but I'm not sure it is really, because Tesla's relatively strong.
Here's Here's Apple in purple here.
Right.
So we can see kind of a divergence there. Apple has been going down this past month or so. Tesla has been going up. Let's do Facebook real quick.
Yeah. Oh, Facebook, I'm sure, is even more pronounced, because Facebook's been having a rough go of it the past couple weeks.
Yeah, Facebook and Apple's charts actually look pretty similar. Facebook in the blue.
Well, if you zoom in, you'll see what I'm talking about, like in the last month.
Right. Yeah. So I mean, it looks like Tesla is kind of holding some relative strength against these other big name FANG stocks. Here, what's another one? Let's do Amazon just to cover our bases. So we got Amazon in the yellow. So yeah, Amazon, Facebook, Apple all look which is surprising. You would expect Facebook to be a little bit more beaten down than the rest of them, which maybe in the last week or so it has been. But yeah, Spencer, that's a good call. That Tesla hasn't really been trading with these other FANG stocks. Let's see, Netflix maybe.
Well, Netflix has also been strong. So Netflix and Tesla have been moving together. Not to say that's for any reason, but they're trending in the same direction right now. Interesting. Yeah, I hear that. Who said that in the chat? Carlos, Tesla hasn't been the same since it's been included in the SPY. Maybe that's a good thing, Carlos. Maybe that's a good thing. I don't know. I don't think anyone. If you go remember what Tesla did last fall, last winter, right after the split, I mean, that was just insane. That move was just insane. So I think it's probably healthy. Those kinds of moves aren't healthy. I think a slow and steady wins the race. So okay, enough about Tesla. The investor presentation was whatever. They're moving their headquarters to Texas. They're gonna expand capacity. Blah blah blah. But chart looks okay to me. What else is on your radar here, AB?
Oh, I'm just checking out SPY right now. It looks very flat today, almost exactly flat, down 0.02% after a couple strong days in a row this week. You know, it looks like today the market is kind of unsure of what it wants to do. Spencer, we've talked about this.
Yeah. Zoom in more. Yeah, because I want to see. So that gap, right, was that from the gap? No, to the left. Like, what was that last week? That was what day was that? Yeah, what day was that? That was the.
This was back in September 20th.
Okay, but what about the next one down? That was last week, right? That was like Friday to Monday.
The one where right here.
Yeah, that guy.
Yeah, that was last. Last Friday was the 1st of October. So last Friday was right here.
Okay.
So this was like the previous.
Okay.
You know, Thursday. Let's see. That was last Friday. Thursday, Wednesday.
Okay. Tuesday. Interesting. Interesting. I mean, it looks like we kind of filled that, and I kind of want to see us hold the lows from the if that's today or yesterday. I can't tell which, but whatever that low is in the last couple of days.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Spencer, we've talked about this before. If you know, are we going to potentially see SPY come all the way back up here to the $453 level before the end of the year? Which right now it's not looking great, but all it takes is a little bit of momentum, some strong green days in a row, and next thing you know, we're talking about, you know, potentially reaching all-time highs again. Of course, we've had a lot of people calling for a correction, and zooming out on this chart, we can see that this quote-unquote correction coming from early September when we did reach those all-time highs has been a little bit more sustained than other dips that we've seen on the way up. You know, even compare it back to, here in March, that this was only in March, three or four red candles. Here we had one, two, three, four red candles in a row, a little green candle here, and then three more red candles. So it's definitely been a bigger move down than just some of these quick little dip and then rips that follow those dips. So we'll have to watch this, Spencer, to see if right here, some people are calling this a bull trap, but I don't know. I'm like the markets right now, Spencer. I'm undecided.
Okay. I still think we're going to see a new all-time high by the end of the year. But that being said, our first guest is here. We have to try to stay on track today because we got a lot of people. So our first guest, Aaron and I were just talking about the cannabis conference next week. Our next guest will be at the Cannabis Capital Conference next week. She is the CEO of Trulieve, Kim Rivers. AB, can we get her on here?
Yes, sir. Let's go ahead and bring Kim Rivers, CEO of Trulieve, on the show. Kim, hey. Welcome to Benzinga Power Hour. How are you doing on this Friday?
Hey, I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm good. So as Spencer mentioned, we have the cannabis conference coming up next week. Yeah. Are you excited?
I'm excited. I mean, I can't believe like I'm going to be somewhere other than behind a computer. So
wait, Kim, is this going to be your first in-person event?
This is my first in-person conference. Yeah. So, you know, it's no better way to get it started, right? Than with Benzinga. So yeah, excited.
We have to all remember how to like behave in a conference.
I know. The whole thing, right? Like I've been thinking about like, okay, do elbow thing, like high fives. I'm not sure, but we'll figure it out. Right.
I don't know. But Kim, we asked you here to talk about, you know, our conference, but also to talk about, the headline from I guess it was last week now. You guys have officially closed the acquisition of Harvest Health and Recreation. Give us the details there.
Yeah, so just had a few things going on. We announced, of course, I think the largest and lowest rate public debt financing, $350 million at a straight 8%. And then right on the heels of that, announced the closing of, I think, the largest U.S. cannabis deal to date, so of Harvest Health and Recreation. So it's been quite a time here at Trulieve. We wouldn't have it any other way. We're so excited to be welcoming the Harvest team into the Trulieve family. Of course, strategically, it was a very transformational deal and will be a very transformational deal for Trulieve as a combined company. We will be the market leader from, of course, a profitability perspective. We'll be neck and neck, we think, on the revenue line as well. And margins, we should be a leader there too. And then on the strategic and operational front, will be certainly the largest from a dispensary footprint with 149 dispensaries across our combined platform, which is about, I think it's 40 or so percent above our next closest competitor. And then when we look at capacity and cultivation, we'll have approximately 1 million square feet more than a competitor, about 50% more with about 3.1 million square feet. And really, it's not just about where we are today, but of course, how this deal and platform sets us up for growth in the future as we're strategically poised in three main hubs, the Southeast, the Northeast, and the Southwest, to take advantage of state-level catalysts as well as future federal catalysts that we believe are coming, again, through a hub model with really strategic distribution being a very key driver for us.
To talk about the hub model for a second there, because if you don't know Trulieve, you guys are your largest market is Florida, correct?
Yeah, so Florida's where we got our start, right. And it's where we're headquartered. I'm a born and raised Floridian, so in Florida presented a unique opportunity for us when we were getting started, in that due to the regulatory requirements in Florida, we were actually able to achieve true scale, and that's something that we really leaned into. So back in 2019, when a lot of other companies were kind of in the land grab mentality, we took a look at internally at ourselves and had a couple of hard conversations. First, we decided that we simply weren't ready to do something transformational. We didn't feel the depth in people or systems to be able to effectively onboard another large scale company. And then secondly, we wanted to develop our strategic thinking around expansion at a deeper level. And so we spent really the last year and a half doing both of those things. And in Florida, we were able to, currently we have 92 stores now. We just actually repositioned the Harvest store, our first Harvest store yesterday. We have another one today in terms of our Florida footprint and a couple million square feet of cultivation. And when we made the decision, instead of, looking externally, but really focusing internally back in at that time, we also decided to double down on Florida. And what that allowed us to do is to understand supply chain start to finish. And also, of course, build up our balance sheet and our financial profile as, Florida allowed us to maintain, again, industry-leading margins and really pull from that cash flow from operations into our expansion strategy. And so as we, again, developed and that's where the hub model started. And so we really decided that scale and being able to operate at scale was going to be very important as the landscape changes over time. And so while we can't transport cannabis products across state lines, we can transport everything else. So from talent, from, equipment in some cases, certainly packaging. We have our own nutrient program that we've developed in-house, SOPs, trainings, et cetera. So really having those centers that we can build around and teams that we can build around across the U.S. as it's divided into regions. That's the strategy that we aligned around. And you saw starting to execute on that strategy with the Northeast expansion with Pennsylvania and Maryland and Connecticut. And of course, Harvest takes that concept and really expands it by adding, of course, a new region for us in the Southwest. They're the market leader in Arizona, as well as they have additional retail in California, production in Nevada, production in Colorado. Of course, we add to our Northeast footprint with an expanded platform in Pennsylvania, as well as adding Maryland to the market and some other markets up in the Northeast. And then, of course, we are able to offset some CapEx in Florida with their cultivation production, then, of course, retail footprint here as well. And I think that it shouldn't be overlooked that both Trulieve and Harvest have had great success from an applications perspective as well. And so we'll be looking to continue our growth, of course, not only through continued expansion organically, but also through applications and new markets. The Southeast has got a ton of markets to turn on, as well as, of course, some strategic M&A.
Kim, for a while there, it seemed like it M&A got a little quiet. Do you expect to, is it just like a land grab now? Do you expect M&A to pick up and just more and more? It's basically what you guys did is you acquired a smaller MSO. Do you just expect more of that in the next couple of years?
I mean, I think it really depends on the particular strategic positioning of the company. For us in Trulieve, I think we've been very transparent in terms of our criteria that we look at and how we evaluate M&A. We've been very disciplined in terms of how we've executed M&A over the years. You know, a number of these transactions take time. I think I've disclosed in the past Purepin, for example, which is our processor cultivator in Pennsylvania. That transaction took about a year for us to really make sure it's a family-owned business. So, you know, oftentimes it's kind of a start-stop process to some of the M&A that happens behind the scenes. But for us, we're going to look to continue to build out hubs. We, you know, have also the Central and Northwest hub yet to be built out, along with making sure that we are achieving, again, true scale and depth in the markets that we do operate in. We think that it's really important not just to be in a market to, you know, check off a state on the map, but to actually provide true access and true penetration to that market in as scaled a way as possible, of course, given the regulatory regimes that are particular in each state.
And Kim, before we let you go here, just what is the next catalyst for it? Can be for you or for the industry, because the acquisition closed and that you know, that was a big deal, but are we waiting on safe banking now or what?
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, it depends on your vantage point. I think that for us, you know, demand has never been stronger. We're seeing, you know, patient and customer growth across all of our markets. Certainly, there are a number of markets that are poised to go rec, which can be a huge catalyst for those particular states. So when we look in the Northeast, of course, Connecticut is about to go rec, Maryland. Also, there's a lot of conversation right now happening in Pennsylvania. We all know what's happening in New York, New Jersey. So the Northeast is in terms of a region. There are a lot of, I believe, near-term catalysts happening there. And then we have, again, new markets that are coming online, which I think is certainly significant for the industry application processes. I would say that state-level catalysts are more for sure of a sure thing in the near term than necessarily, you know, broad range, you know, federal catalysts. I think what that does is it puts everyone back into a position where we have to operate smart. We have to make sure that we're being good stewards of capital, that we're very specific in terms of the ROI of dollars invested in markets, and that we're making strategic decisions that are best for our shareholders and, of course, for our business. But overall, again, you know, the business and the market has never been stronger. And I think that in terms of, you know, federal change, certainly safe banking and potentially safe banking plus looks poised to go. But we have to, you know, we have to somehow break through the kind of, you know, standoff posturing that we've got right now between the House and Senate, which I'm hopeful will happen, you know, prior to the midterms.
All right. Kim Rivers, CEO of Trulieve. Kim, we will see you next week.
Yes.
At our Cannabis Capital Conference. Very exciting.
Awesome. Thanks, guys.
Thanks.
Thank you, Kim.
See ya.
All right. I see Hot Stocks Luke in the background. He's lurking. He's lurking.
Uh-oh.
Oh, gosh. Luke, fix your microphone, man.
Rohan.
Come on. This Rohan. Is Bush League. I'm here with – it's bad enough that I'm here without a camera.
All right. Let's try one more time.
Is he fixed? Do we have it?
I thought that fixed it.
Yeah, we fixed it.
Did I? All right, Jesus, just give me 2 minutes, okay?
Okay.
I got to manage Aaron Brie while you're out, you know, having a fever.
I do not have a fever. I have a lingering cough, some congestion, but no fever. Everything is mostly okay. Our next guest has a title that I think we all could probably have. His title is Director of Investor Intelligence, which I think between the three of us, we don't have much of that.
We probably have some good investor intelligence if you combine all three of us.
So all right, look at this, Spencey. This is why I wanted you to stay on for a second.
What's up?
I hit a hell of a lick this week. GM.
Oh, look at the GM, the October 15th calls.
At the money. Wow.
Very nice, Luke.
I told Aaron Brie I have not been trading at all, and I just wanted to put some major YOLOs down there. So we went out, we bought some at-the-money calls on GM, expiring in the very short term. We went deep into some of the crypto stocks that weren't moving, and we hit some major licks this week.
So the thesis here was on Tuesday, we had good news come out from GM in regards to the company's revenue and their EV, and the stock hadn't moved off the news yet. That's what we do here at Benzinga is we deliver the news. We try to do it faster than everyone else. And so it's interesting when you have what should be a positive catalyst for a stock and the stock doesn't end up moving, you can kind of get out ahead of it, which is what we were able to do here. So, Luke, great trade.
Boom. That was exactly it. I was going to say, don't convolute my YOLO trades with theses, but that was the thesis. Was that stock didn't move, monster news, analyst ratings are going to come out, hit the short, the at the money short term calls, and they went for us. Nice 300% in 2 days.
That portfolio was strange. I saw GameStop, I saw Home Depot, I saw Genius Brands. You got some weird stuff in there, man.
And you saw FXI, I got ETFs in there too, baby.
Oh, sure you do. Hey.
All right, now let's bring on our next guest. He's been patiently waiting. Yeah. You know, he's the one who's actually going to be able to give us insights versus me just feeling the need to have some energy in my life and hit some of these trades.
You just want to feel something.
Ed, what's going on, man?
Hi, guys. How's it going?
Going well. How are you doing?
I'm good. Thank you very much for having me on the show.
100%. And for everybody out there who doesn't know, so Ed is coming to us from a company called SimilarWeb. And for us as publishers, SimilarWeb is something that we're very familiar with. It's a tool that we use on a regular basis. But I imagine that there are a lot of folks out there who are not publishers and may not know what SimilarWeb does and how it can be helpful for us in the investing space. So Ed, can you tell us what SimilarWeb is?
Sure thing. So I come from the part of the business with a totally different use case on how you guys are using the tool overall.
That's fine.
So
right. Come from a more interesting part of the business, okay?
The investing part, obviously. So SimilarWeb, we provide web and app traffic data. So we provide estimation data. So virtually every single website in the world, we have an algorithm that estimates how many people are visiting that website, how long they're spending on that website, what words they're searching for to get on there. And we can even have granularity on how many people are visiting, like a conversion page, like a transaction page, how many people are logging in. We can even look at the number of customers on these websites as well.
Wait, I have a question for Ed. Ed, how many people have been to Aussie.com in the last couple of weeks?
And Aussie.com, I mean, I can quickly look this up as well. I'll look this up as I'm speaking, and I'll come back to Aussie.com.
Okay,
I'm sure
okay,
it's probably
okay.
Actually gone up since it's gone in the news.
Sure.
As a business, we are like we're traditionally selling to kind of companies like yourselves at Benzinga. So publishers that we're looking to basically look what other publishers like Aussie, how many people are visiting their website, or even what words people are searching to get to that. About 3 or 4 years ago, we suddenly started finding that there was actually a large use for the investment industry, who are basically looking to use the same data to get an early read in what companies are reporting. So to give an example, it could be investors looking at like Netflix to be, so our data is delivered in pretty much real time. We have a 1 to 2 day lag from when the actual event happens. So we would have a read on, let's say, Netflix's web traffic or Facebook's web traffic 2 days ago. So way ahead of when these businesses actually releasing the financial results. So we've been
saying, do you mind if I just hop in really quick?
Yes, go for it.
Okay. So let's use your Netflix example, right? Because you're talking about Netflix's web traffic. Do you have insights into other platforms as well? Like the app traffic that Netflix may get, or a smart TV or anything along those lines?
So we don't actually have, so we have some form of app traffic. It's not as comprehensive as our web traffic data. We can see basic stuff like monthly active users, daily active users, but like overall usage, we can't see TV. But with alternative data sets like ours, what you're essentially trying to do is get a proxy to what the actual is going on in the business, essentially. So you're trying to correlate web traffic data to actual business performance. So with app data that is available, so third-party estimation app data, you can look at usage on it, like monthly active users, but you can't actually look at transactions. With web data, you can look at transactions and you can look at usage. So the thing that we can see on Netflix is the number of people who are signing up, by the number of people visiting the sign-up page, and also the number of people who are canceling as well. So we can actually look at net ads, and we actually have a very good correlation overall with net ads for Netflix. So we can see how many people are net ads in every market pretty much that operating. So the US, India, UK, France, Germany. So you can get a level of granularity, which not even these companies are reporting themselves.
I love that geography breakdown. That's awesome.
So I mean, a very, very cool insight that we had on Netflix a couple of years ago. We were able to, like, Netflix, I think it was 2019, they were slowing down in international growth. And we caught this before anyone in the markets had seen this, because we had seen net subscriber trends were actually decelerating. And actually this had an impact on the overall stock price of Netflix, based off our data, having that early read before Netflix released the results.
Ed, can you tell us, like, what are the top trending, you know, websites right now or brands right now? It could be uptrend or downtrend.
So I would say from the e-commerce space, one of the most interesting sites that we're looking at right now is Shopify in general. So Shopify works. There's two ways of looking at Shopify websites. So it's either websites that have the subdomain something, myshopify.com, or websites that have a Shopify technology on these sites as well. And an interesting insight that we actually put out recently is that when we looked at all the available Shopify domains, the ones that had Shopify in the URL and ones that just had the technology, total visits to all of these sites now surpasses Amazon visits as well, which is super cool, but this is the first time we've actually ever seen any competitor to Amazon overtake Amazon in any way or even grow market share. So Amazon is actually losing visit market share. So that's slightly different from sales market share, but the fact that Shopify is getting a bigger reach is phenomenal. And like we think this is basically driven by the fact that Shopify is giving D2C brands like mom and pop shops the ability to sell directly to consumers and without such stringent sellers terms that Amazon actually has as well.
So Ed, I mean, I assume with something, you know, we've thrown out a couple examples with different companies out there, but let's take a company maybe like Six Flags, like an amusement park. Is it as simple as seeing
how they're performing? So to be honest, I haven't actually tracked how they're doing. So the way that alternative data essentially works and what investors are doing with alternative data sets like ours, they're basically putting together different pieces of the puzzle. And putting that all together to kind of understand what a business is doing. So a business like Six Flags, how do they operate? They sell tickets either directly on their website, or they sell tickets at the door. When you go to a theme park, you buy it on the door, or they might sell it through like a referral partner or something like that. So web traffic on its own isn't necessarily the best way to understand how a business like Six Flags is performing. if you were to really understand how Six Flags is performing as an investor, investors will be buying things like credit card data, so tracking credit card spend either online or at the door or at the gates of Six Flags. So we can see rough trends that website visits for Six Flags are kind of recovering post-pandemic, but it's not really the best read to track a business like that.
As you're thinking about building out the service, right, and continuing to provide more for investors, something that would be helpful for a business like a Six Flags is if you would just stand outside the gate, you know, you just tally up the people as they walk in, you know, it's like you know, they're counting and reporting that back to us. But.
So that's the very old school way of doing alternative data. This is what hedge funds were doing about 10, 15 years ago, literally just counting cars in a car parking lot. The more modern way of doing this would actually be looking at geolocation. So rather than having someone actually counting, there are data providers like Placer and Advan that basically track movements from people's sales phones. So what hedge funds will be looking to do to track the performance of Six Flags will be looking at the number of people physically located in these theme parks and tracking that over time. And then you combine that with credit card data, and then you combine that with website traffic data, and you get a full picture of actually what is actually happening for a business like Six Flags.
Yeah, Ed, you mentioned it. That's always the data that I think of when I think of alternative data is the hedge funds that would buy, you know, the satellite images of car parking lots and seeing how many cars are in which lots, if more cars are in Walmarts than they were, you know, a couple months ago. So, Ed, I'm curious, who's currently using this data from SimilarWeb? Is it mostly on the institutional side?
You have one unheard message.
Hi, I was calling Current, the influencer marketing platform, but I think I just got redirected to a bunch of people listening to a podcast. Well, anyways, I was calling Current because I was told they could help get my brand set up on TikTok Shop. And even build out an affiliate program of content creators promoting my brand. And even have those content creators go on live streams and promote my product there. Wow, I could really use Current. I also heard that the brands they work with are making millions in sales. I guess I'll just go to their website at current.tech.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
So we do have a mixture actually as well. So I would say when we started building this out, our core market was institutional investors. We're used by hundreds of hedge funds. We are cited in equity research reports by about 20 Wall Street firms. Think Citi, Barclays, UBS, JP Morgan. Our data is regularly being cited in these reports, and actually they're making calls on companies based off our data as well, like changing if it's a buy, sell, or a hold based off SimilarWeb data. We also sell to VC funds as well, private equity funds too. But we are seeing more and more individual investors starting to buy our data as well. They either could be kind of more quantitative traders, but we're also seeing retail investors beginning to start to use our free tool to kind of get a read on what's going on in companies overall.
So something that would be great, Ed, and you know, I don't know how far along you guys are with the retail investor strategy, but we should figure out some way where we can pull our data together and create some sort of retail signal. Because we get the only users we get are tens of millions of retail traders every single month. And again, I know SimilarWeb from the publisher standpoint, and I've used it for my directional stock trading for years and think it's something that's very powerful. Even just like, you know, the free level data that I get where it's the number of visitors to the website over time, I always check that out. So I'd imagine that there's some sort of really cool product or reporting, et cetera, we could do.
I would definitely love to see how we can explore that together as well. And I can tell you from a product strategy, definitely in the medium to long term, we're thinking about how do we go in more into the retail market. But look, I definitely think, like Luke, as you said, like using data like ours, I think a lot of people make it sound much more complicated than it actually is in terms of actually using alternative data as part of an investment process. Essentially, I see data usage as really like two things. One, which is, does it tell you something that you did not know beforehand? So is a company like Lululemon, Peloton's a good example. Like you could use basic web traffic data to see that Peloton visits are declining, sorry. And then you would get an early read, as in Q2, that the business is no longer so strong as it was during the pandemic. The other major use of data really is, does it, as Luke, I think as you're using it, is does it confirm my hypothesis on the company? Is the company growing? Is the web traffic data still going up? Yes, it is. And that's how anyone can use the data. And we actually do have a free tool that anyone can use and download. If you go to the Google Chrome store, you can download our SimilarWeb plugin and you can get six months of free web traffic data. And anyone can do that.
Oh, that's great. And you're spot on with how I use it. And there was a comment that was just up on the screen a second ago, which I think fits in perfectly with this. It's okay. So the comment is, if you don't know why you're holding a stock, you shouldn't hold it. And like sort of that paradigm of thinking is where I leverage a similar web data personally. You know, it's like, okay, I have this thesis. I'm going through my portfolio. I want to check if this thesis is still true, right? Is the reason why I bought the stock still holding? And that's where seeing, yeah, okay, it's still getting more popular. There's progressively more people. It's an accelerating rate of change of users. And that's where I think the similar web data can be so powerful.
Definitely.
But yeah, and I will say I'm bummed that I learned you guys have this business line and you're out here telling people about it because I thought it was like my edge.
I'm sorry, forget everything I said.
Luke, that's Ed's job. Come on now, Luke, extrapolating off that and using like a tangible example. I know earlier in the year after, when Trump came out of office, we were talking about shorting New York Times because our thesis was people are going to be visiting New York Times. Less, and that's, a tangible example where we can go in and see the traffic going to New York Times' homepage and seeing, okay, is our thesis correct? Are there less monthly viewers than there were a couple months ago? And so, I don't know exactly how some of our audience may use this data, if it's to try to find trade ideas or to just either confirm or essentially, deny their thesis that they have on a certain company.
So I would say the challenge that we've also had with our data, so we've been a business that started selling to kind of corporates and publishers and has moved into selling to the investor space. So one of my jobs and remits is how do we translate the online world into basically tracking the stock market? And there's a lot of changes you need to do the data. You need to map domains to tickers as well. You need to organize the data in a certain way. For it to really be valuable for investors. Once we've done the organization of the data in a certain way, it will be much easier to use this as an ideation tool. So to be able to like find which stocks are trending. So you can do that with our data right now. It just takes a level of organization that the kind of the product which we're developing the product to be working towards. And that's one of our big initiatives actually next year. So I would say in general, like the best way to use data like ours is if you're tracking a load of stocks anyway, checking for inflections which you did not expect, or really just basically using website traffic data to provide you with more confidence in your thesis. Like the New York Times, is it going to be underperforming now because no one's tracking Trump? You could use that easily to confirm that thesis.
Yep. All right, Ed, well, thank you for joining us, taking time out of your Friday to join us on the Power Hour. I know we discussed, maybe you coming on again subsequently ahead of certain companies' data where we can actually take a deep dive using
yes, I love that.
Into companies before data, or companies before earnings. So thanks again for joining us, and I hope you have a great Friday and weekend.
Thank you. And do you want the Aussie media statistic?
Oh, yeah.
Yes, yeah, yes, so, I'm curious.
Interestingly, so web traffic to Aussie media tripled last week. So basically the whole thing right now has been an amazing marketing campaign for them.
Oh, fantastic. Fantastic. Yeah. Thank you. Perfect. Thank you so much for that insight. I had a feeling, but now I know for sure.
Fantastic. Thanks for having me in the show. All right.
Thanks, Ted.
Bye.
All right. Luke, did you learn something? Oh no, Luke dipped out.
Wait, what was the why the question about Aussie? I think I might have missed something.
Oh, do you not know about that from last week, man? Aussie Media, like, do you know what that is, first of all? Do you know what
I went to the website after you mentioned it. I don't think I've ever been here on this website before.
Oh, that right there is the very problem. They're one of those new media websites, and then the company kind of imploded last week. I'll send you a link about it. Basically, they tried to be like Vice, but they had no traffic. And then the New York Times wrote an article about how they were on a call with Goldman Sachs because Goldman Sachs was trying to invest in them. And then the president of the company impersonated the head of YouTube. It was a whole thing. It was a whole thing.
Who do anyway. You? Okay, so you're relating Aussie to like a Vice like outlet?
Yeah, Vice like, but never quite able to build an audience. The fact that you hadn't been there is the point. But
not
that
only
said,
never been there, I've never even heard of it. All right, yeah
we're
running behind.
That's the problem. So okay, wait, we're running behind. Let's bring on our next guest here because I see him here backstage, Dennis Calvert, the CEO of BioLargo. Let's get Dennis on the show here.
Dennis, how are we doing? Thank you for taking time out of your Friday to join us on Benzinga's Power Hour.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Aaron. Spencer, great to be here. Great show. Love it.
Dennis, tell us what you're working on right now.
Oh, man. There's a lot going on at BioLargo. You know, we've got a journey of innovation that's a little over a decade. And, you know, heavy R&D, somewhat painful journey. I mean, you know, as I always say, we're doing some of the hardest work in the world. We're solving problems that other people can't solve. And so our mission is
such as
well, so like PFAS, PFAS, where we developed a technique for taking fluorinated compounds, which are called forever chemicals, out of water and out of soil. And if you do a little internet search, you'll see that that's estimated to be about an $80 billion emerging market a year. Some people call it a $1 trillion market. PFAS has been detected in water streams all over the world, mostly in industrialized concentrated areas. And it turns out that it's forever chemical. Nature won't break it down. So what happens is it sticks around, sticks around, and sticks around. It was used for 38 years in nonstick coatings. There's been lawsuits and massive litigation all over the world. It's called the contaminant of the decade. It's in your body. It's in your cosmetics. It's in your food. It's in your food packaging. And it's in your water. And it turns out in concentration, it's been linked, not a causation, it's been linked to adverse health effects like cancer and birth defects. So, you know, in our backyard, we're headquartered in Westminster, California. We've got operations in Tennessee and Canada and Denver. We got a lot going on at BioLargo. We set out about 2 years ago, got a grant from the EPA, developed a technique for extraction, and it's really pretty phenomenal. It's in its commercial phase now, first commercial trials. We're working with two of the largest, most prominent customers in the world. And we'd like to get that thing launched in Q1 2022. And it's a massive opportunity for the company. And it's, you know, years in the making, of course. So that's just one. We've got more. So
is this just a case of, I mean, I feel like whatever you're developing would have to get some kind of EPA approval or something like that, right?
Well, in this case, yeah, it's actually a little different. In this case, you just got to get it out. They test before and they test after, and if it's out, it's out.
Okay.
So it's really interesting, and it's, you know, there's a number of challenges. It's in industrial water, it's in municipal water, you know, in Orange County, California, that's my backyard. Within 40 minutes of our office, there's 40 wells that have been detected. So these wells supply drinking water. They're then processed, put into the drinking water system. Everybody drinks it. And they've detected concentration levels above detection limits, which means they got to get it out. So what they do is they shut down the well. So just think about that. They can't sell water with PFAS in it. So they stop selling it. Then they have to buy water somewhere else. And this is a desert. California is a desert. Water crisis in California is the real deal. And so in this local market, the cost to treat total to remove that PFAS and deliver clean water is estimated to be about $1.5 billion. And again, I mention that because that's within 40 minutes of my office. And this is a global problem. It's all over the world. And so this is just one of the emerging market opportunities that's in our company, and we're in it to win it. So it's really fascinating. Our slogan is we make life better. And so the simple version of the company is air, water, and earth, right? All things environmental, all things sustainable, focused on solving big challenges. And it's a little over a decade of work, heavy R&D. One of our assets, a technology for treating micropollutants in water, has received over 100 grants. 100.
Wait, Dennis, how long does one of these things take to bring to market, one of these products?
Well, that asset's 6 years, actually. We have a medical products that we've also licensed into a subsidiary that's really prepared for a spin out. That asset's about 6 years of development. We've got some consumer products that had some early success and then a lot of pain. They're reemerging with the right partners, which is awesome. And so those are about 7 years of development work to get those positioned for significance. You know, we say significance, you know, each of these has a different threshold of opportunity, but, you know, PFAS is massive. So let me just give you some sense of that. When you go into the market, one of the key assets in the company, about 3 years ago, we started our own engineering group. And fascinating, this group was a team that had worked together for 20 and 30 years all over the world and were technical support for one of the largest engineering firms in the world. And we had a chance to come in and do some development work. They had a big bad event corporate that was the Chicago Bridge and Iron, CB&I, had an implosion about 3 years ago. And when that happened, 18,000 people got a pink slip. Just think about that, 18,000 people had spent their career working for big companies. So our small entrepreneurial, out-of-the-box thinker, you know, innovator on the cutting edge of some of the most significant problems brought in this group all at once, significant risk. We took great financial risk. Well, that group is just killing it. These guys have a team that had literally worked in some of the most high-profile cases like pumping out New Orleans post-Katrina, the largest processor of dioxin remediation in the world, literally 1,000 remediation projects under their belt as a career. And that's the core engine that brings solutions to bear in BioLargo's team that includes a host of scientists. So we've got about 36 people, something like 7 PhDs and 11 engineers, and wrapped in an entrepreneur spirit that says, let's focus on things that are meaningful, big challenges that will move the needle financially.
Got it.
We're at an apex as a company, sort of this breakout moment where revenue of significance is right at hand, and the evidence is everywhere. You know, just a few weeks ago, we announced, you know, our engineers picked up another, I don't know, $1.2 million in contracts. You said, oh, what's $1.2 million? Well, that was in 1 week. 1 week.
We'll have to keep tabs on that. You said you expect more in the first quarter. Dennis Calvert from BioLargo. Dennis, we're up against the clock here, but thanks for coming on Power Hour today.
Symbol BLGO. Thanks, guys.
All right.
See you.
We have somehow managed to stay more or less on time today, AB. I don't know how you and I have done it, but I do see our next guest here. You want to bring Mr. Quast on?
Yeah. Well, let's bring Mr. Quast on. I just got the BioLargo chart pulled up here. Dennis mentioned, ticker BLGO. Stock is currently trading at about 18 cents. Seems like it's been pretty, as quiet as it can be over the last, 4 months or so, trading in this range from about 15 cents up to 22. So I like to see, Spencer, I don't know about you, but I like to see some consolidation trading sideways sometimes for a stock like this. But all right, enough of me bloviating.
Yeah, enough of that.
Time to bring on Mr. Tim Quast.
Let's bring on someone who actually knows who he's talking about. Tim.
I don't know if this guy qualifies, but...
Well, bloviating is one of my favorite words because I do a lot of it. So I'm glad that you used that, AB.
Tim,
Spencer, nice to see you.
Tim, I know you can't see me, but you can hear me.
I can't. Your face.
That's all that matters.
Frozen in time. Right?
Well, you're not actually speaking to Spencer. You're speaking to Spencer's AI, but it's close enough.
That's handy.
Tim, I got to get your reaction to... Actually, no, not your reaction to the number, your reaction to the reaction to the jobs number today.
Well, number one, I find it fascinating that the Bureau of Labor Statistics, which produces that data, a government bureau has any credibility. I mean, if we as a data analytics company missed a number by 60%, we would have zero credibility. How can you have an expectation of 500,000 and deliver a number of 200,000? And of course, I can't direct all of the recrimination at the BLS because it's all the economists who then project, who say, well, we think it's going to be 500,000 and then it's two. You could flip a coin and do better. So apologies to, you know, so I know Mark Zandi at Moody's and Austin Goolsbee at the University of Chicago and Rick Santelli at CNBC. I have gotten to know all those people over the years. So I'm teasing them in part, but I do find it fascinating that those numbers are so often so wildly off. That's my humorous reaction, Spencer. The economic reaction, and we actually know a fair amount about this, is that it should be no surprise that there is a slowdown in jobs data, and then we'll talk about the ramification for traders. If what we're doing is diminishing the value of the capital input and discouraging the application of the labor input, products and services are broadly, setting aside what the economists like to call total factor productivity. And I'll keep this very simple, folks. Don't check out. You know, it takes money and people to create stuff and to provide services. And so if the value of money declines, it takes more money to produce the same stuff. And if the value of money declines, the cost of the labor input, what you have to pay people, increases. Well, if both of those things happen, productivity, what is left over after you put people and money to work to create stuff, shrinks. Well, what will happen? This is not complex stuff to figure out. It will mean, despite the fact that we have a lot of job openings, there will be less and less capacity for businesses to pay what people want to be paid. And so then the labor force shrinks, the people who want to actually get a job, they decide to live at a lower standard of living. And all of that feeds into a slowdown in our output. That's what happens. So then how could we possibly expect the economy to boom ahead if the labor input is shrinking and the capital input is too? That's the problem. So now, what do we do as traders around that? You could say, well, I'm going to bank on the fact that no matter what I just described to you, which is the truth, that we're going to believe that the economy is somehow going to grow 6%. And so I'm going to bet that there is a long-term opportunity in the equity market. Look, you can do that if you want. But I think what was illustrated today is you can have a very bad number. And in the space of 30 seconds, while CNBC's panel was talking about it, the Dow Jones Industrial Average futures went from 50 points up to about 50 points down. And before the sentence was over, they were up 70 points. So what is the connection between jobs and how stocks behave? It used to be highly correlated. Today it is not.
Well, I was going to ask you, there's a connection between the jobs. There's some loose connection between the jobs number and the expectations for a rate hike. And there is a connection between rates and how stocks perform. So whether or not, you know, today's number changes the picture at all, I'm not quite sure it does. It seems like the market is expecting at least one hike in the next 12, 13 months or so. But it doesn't seem like your position with regards to stocks has changed.
Well, I'll tell you what we think about stocks, and I'm going to do this with data because this is, you know, that while the Fed claims to be data driven, it constantly changes the data that it uses to determine what drives it. We don't. We look at supply and demand in the equity market. It doesn't, you know, so all of these numbers, interest rates, economic growth, supply chain, employment levels, all of those things are inputs into supply and demand. Money is the biggest. But supply and demand is a constant barometer of what to expect from the equity market. So traders, if you, this is very important because it will help you take gains and not chances. And that's what we want. Unless we can all get together and somehow change the conditions that are affecting the unpredictability of outcomes, we're going to have to adapt to them. And I think that this is what we've done. We've provided a way to adapt to the fact that fundamentals are a shrinking input, and that we don't know what effect an expectation for interest rate hikes will have. You know, when the Fed said we want to begin to decrease our rate of asset purchases, once again, here's something it's important to know, traders. It's easy that you want to clear a room at a cocktail party, start talking about monetary policy. All of a sudden, people will have to pick up their children or whatever. But it's important to understand this, that the reason money is such a big input is because everything is denominated in it. You and I generally trade time for money. So when the Fed creates more money without an increase in created time, then the amount of time we have to trade for money means that our standard of living is going to shrink. If the value of the money that you and I trade our time for diminishes, then our standard of living declines over time. We have to work longer. So that's why it should concern you. We should all be concerned about this. You know, Coinage Act of 1792, the first action that Congress took on what the Constitution said about fixing the rate of exchange for our coin and foreign coin, made it a death penalty felony to willfully alter the value of the currency. Well, now
I think we're getting a little off course here.
I'm bringing it all around.
All right, okay. Yes.
These are important things that people need to understand.
Okay.
Because if you don't understand why the value of money matters, you're going to lose as a trader. That's the problem. You have to understand the relationship, and it begins with some background. So now our policy is to do what we used to put people to death for. We willfully alter the value of the currency. Well, that's going to have a measurable effect on the value of risk assets. So now I'm going to answer your question. Here's what I think about that. So if we go look at broad sentiment. We have this measure of supply and demand across the whole market. So here's my view, Spencer. The first half of this graph, I think you can see my screen here. Let me hide that. See these very high peaks and troughs and peaks and troughs for sentiment. This is for the S&P 500. That is a product of pushing an immense amount of money into the market to chase risk assets like stocks. So we had this very, very aggressive momentum market. Well, it stopped in April. So what we're experiencing now is a product of the slowdown of momentum then. It takes a while. It's like if you speed in your car, you do 100 miles an hour and you take your foot off the gas, it takes a while for the vehicle to slow down. But the event that causes the slowdown is you lifting your foot off the gas pedal. Well, that happened here. Now we're beginning to experience the effects of this. This top, this very weak top, I say weak tops precede drops. And it's because it's telling us that this drug, money, that flooded into the market and consumed of risk assets and caused them to rise has run out. So then we're sitting here in this moment studying the jobs data and what the Fed's talking about, when we should have been looking back here and saying, here's the problem. Here's when you have to begin to change your behavior about how to think about the market. That's the fact. So what do we do as traders? Well, you buy rising demand and you make sure that you sell falling demand. Buy rising demand, sell falling demand.
Okay,
you repeat
so
that process over and over, and you can win.
Can you like maybe show us one that has an example, like an example of that in practice?
Well, let's look at cannabis.
You were just
talking with BioLargo. BioLargo is over-the-counter OTC.
Yeah, I don't know how much data you'll have on that.
I don't, and by the way, FINRA is looking at making some requirements for order routing in that market, but it doesn't have the same rules. But we can look at cannabis as a group. So
okay.
Here's cannabis as a group. So over the last 30 days, so 5 is your nexus. 5 is above that, more demand than supply. Below that, more supply than demand. Over the last 30 days, there has been a clear bias to deteriorating demand. Short volume has been on an uptrend. So supply is increasing. Now, the last couple of days, there have been short covering in the group. But I would look at that and say, if you're interested in cannabis at the moment, don't buy it, because money is withdrawing from cannabis. We'll wait to find a better time. If you want to look at Tilray, probably the kingpin right now for that industry. It's a 1.8 out of 10, and the sentiment trend is down, and it's 47% short. You see that?
Yeah.
Here, right here, right here. 1.8, sentiment down, 46.9% short. That means almost half of its trading volume comes from borrowed stock. So if I look at the supply-demand equation, I'm not buying that. What I want is the reverse of that. The supply side is not bad. It's falling. But until demand increases, until this chart reverses and shows us a strong upward surge in demand, why take chances? It's not a good time to trade that stock. And you could come up with 100 reasons why it might be, and you'll still lose money on it. Now you'd say, well, what is my time frame? I think you have to adapt to the market. The market is a very short-term instrument. And if we want to be successful in it, that's how we have to think about it.
Tim Kwas is the founder and CEO of Market Structure Edge, giving us thoughts on stocks that have rising demand, falling demand, and somehow talking about other things in the process. Tim. It all fits together. I will talk to you on Monday.
We'll see you then.
All right.
Thank you, Spencer. AB, Tim, good to see you.
Yeah, okay. Have a great weekend.
AB, before we go here, can we just do a real quick crypto update? I know we've wanted to there's been people in the chat talking about SHIB. Can we pull up a crypto heat map and look at SHIB for a second?
Let's do it, Spencer. So SHIB's not on the heat map, so I'll have to pull that up separately.
Oh, it's not big enough to make the heat map.
Not yet.
All right, not yet.
So, all right, we can see here, Spencer, looking at the heat map. Let me give a couple zooms in. Bitcoin and Ethereum, obviously the two biggest cryptocurrencies, are trading slightly higher today. Ethereum outpacing Bitcoin, up nearly 1%, while Bitcoin is up about 0.25%. Solana having a strong day, up 8.5%. Dogecoin up more than 2%. Litecoin is up as well. Ripple up slightly. Who's in the red, Spencer? We have Cardano in the red. Ticker ADA is down about 0.75%. Internet Computer. I don't know if there's a more interesting name. Well, there's a lot of interesting names for computers. Insane Clown Posse. All right, but let's go to
I see Solana. So my cost basis in Solana is 106.92. Yeah,
you're looking pretty good. It's at 167 right now.
Hey, I'm in the green.
All right, so let's check on Shiba in the last 24 hours. Shiba is up 2%. Let's zoom out a week, up 277% on the week. On the month, 350%. Now let's do Floki real quick. Floki, Floki. Oh,
I don't even know what this is.
So, Spencer, do you know what type of dog the Dogecoin, you know, meme was created off of?
Yeah, it was a right?
It was a Shiba Inu.
Shiba, right? Yeah.
So they went out and created a Shiba Inu coin in honor of the dog that was created from Dogecoin.
Okay.
Do you know who's the most famous proponent, you could say, of Dogecoin?
Elon Musk.
And Elon Musk went out and bought a Shiba dog, and can you guess what he named it?
This.
Yes, this Floki. So the
We've
genius,
come full circle.
It comes full circle.
Right.
It comes full circle. We have why is this not okay? Here we go. Down here we can see. So in the last 7 days, Floki coin is up 36% on the month, up 377%.
Insane. We are living in a simulation.
Elon might say so.
This is insane. All right. Wow. Anyway. It's 102. Is Neil doing a show today? I think he is, right?
Yeah, we're doing just a little Friday fun day on Get All Technical.
Right. Oh, my gosh. All right, AB, I'll let you go sit up for that, and I'll wrap it up here. Everyone, hopefully I'll be back on camera on Monday. I intend to be back on camera on Monday. I'm getting some equipment delivered later today. Actually, AB is supposed to deliver some equipment to me. So I can stream from my apartment for the next few days while I'm stuck in COVID quarantine. Please send me food and games and your Netflix password to keep me entertained because I am trapped at home and can't go anywhere. But in all seriousness, thanks to Tim and Dennis and Kim. and Ed for coming on the show today. Thanks everyone for watching. Please hit that like button, and please remember all the information from our show is meant to be used as informational purposes, not for investing or trading advice. Yes, exactly right. I should not be spreading the Rona to the chat. But I actually feel okay. I felt a lot better today than I did on Tuesday. No joke, though. I honestly did. Like, I went to the office this week. That was a very, very bad thing of me to do. But I went to the office on Monday and Tuesday when I was carrying COVID. So let that be a lesson. If you have cold-like symptoms, maybe don't leave your home because, hey, it could be COVID. It could be COVID. So don't do what I did because that was stupid. Okay. So Neil's going to go live now, Friday Fun Day. After Neil, we've got Moon or Bust. And then I'll be back with y'all at 3:30 with Joel. Yeah, thanks to Trace. I looked like crap. Hey, you know what? I didn't feel so hot. I didn't feel so hot. That's funny, man. All right. I'm feeling a little better now, but I'm still a little bit congested. And I got my vitamin D here and my vitamin C and my vitamin B and my Sudafed. So I'm doing all right. Everyone, stay tuned for Neil, get technical, stay green today. I'll catch you guys in a little bit.
Did you know nearly all stock price changes of 10% or more result from a single news headline? That's right. News headlines have a unique ability to drive stock prices up or down. These news catalysts create trading opportunities every day. All you need is a little help to reach out and take them. And if you're looking to grow your portfolio, it doesn't matter if your investment budget is small or big. An easy-to-read stream of news headlines will increase your opportunities to profit from price changes in the stock market, consolidate a knowledge-based investment strategy, and grow your portfolio. All you need is Benzinga Pro and its powerful news alerts, price tracking, and portfolio monitoring to make a positive change in your trading performance. We've already helped thousands of retail traders across the world, and they could not be happier. Increase your market knowledge, boost your exposure to big movers, and make informed trades before major price changes. The opportunities are all around you. Subscribe now, and we'll skyrocket your portfolio today.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.